Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw. This is our grand finale for the Sundance Film Festival series of podcasts I've been doing. And I'm very happy to be joined by a couple of guests that I'm always just really ecstatic to talk with. We'll start with Manola Dargis. Hello, Manola.
Hello, Nick.
And Amy Taubin.
Hi, Nick. Hi, Manola.
Hi.
So we are all now back, safe and sound, happily in our respective homesteads. But we've had sort of different experiences a little bit. So that might be kind of interesting for our perspectives on the festival. So I was there, but for a really short time. So then did a lot of online viewing. Amy, you were mainly at home.
I was only at home, but before the festival started, I got shown some things that were in actual theaters, actual screening rooms. So, but mostly I was sitting in front of my computer screen.
And Manola, you did the whole kind of the whole soup to nuts, more or less.
Yeah, more or less. I was from Thursday to Thursday. Then we can talk briefly if you want, just about like what the experience was, because it was kind of a little bit different from the past. And then I've watched a couple movies since coming home, and I'm going to watch a couple more tonight.
Well, let's pick up from that. What was special or distinctive about this year?
Well, just very briefly, one of the things that they did, and I didn't really like it, but I do now understand it, is they really overloaded the first day. And I believe that there were 17 movies the first day, which is impossible, of course, because no one can see 17 movies in a single day. And then one of the things that they did this year is that all of the movies in the program on the official in the slate would have had their premieres by Tuesday. And that was really interesting because what they basically did is it's not so much a capitulation, but more an acknowledgement of how the industry treats the festival in any event. The industry treats the festival as a very long weekend. And so after years of it being a problem, what they wanted to do is that all of the premieres would be done by Tuesday so that. That I think was a way of kind of encouraging the industry to stay till Tuesday, but then you will have had an opportunity for you and your people to have seen everything. And so they did that. That was interesting. What was interesting also, there were fewer theaters in Park City that were showing movies, and there were fewer screenings in Park City, but there were more screenings in Salt Lake City, which is about an hour away, an hour drive. So they put many more screenings there in Salt Lake. Which was a little frustrating if you were in Park City. And then, basically the industry, like most of California, all the California people had left, after the first 5 days. And then the festival, I was there, Wednesday and Thursday going to screenings, and they were packed screenings, but they were packed with locals. So, which is really interesting. 75% of the people who go to Sundance are actually from Utah, which is a much higher number than I would have thought, which was interesting. And so they really kind of divided it into different kind of sections. But I think the more important thing is like by Tuesday, everything had a premiere. And so that way the industry could see things and then they just vacate. So that was different.
If I can add something, as a person who's been going to Sundance since 1989, which was the year of Six Flags and Videotape, when everything supposedly changed after that. For a couple of years after that, everything would also premiere in the first half, and you would buy an A package or a B package if you were industry. And if you went to the A package, you could see everything, and that was through Wednesday. And then the B package came in like overnight, Wednesday to Sunday. And the advantage of the B package was none if you wanted to buy films. But if, like me, you were writing about the festival, everyone told you everything that was good. So you could go and see everything in the B package. It was exactly the same as the A package. And they stopped doing that around, I think, 95 or 96, when they tried to get people to stay for the whole thing and say, you can't have seen this by going home in the middle.
So that became a problem because there were things like I would stay usually for 1 week, and invariably there will be movies that were premiering on Friday only. And they were often things you felt like they didn't want critics to see, or journalists to see, but there would be things that were in those lat the tail end. Now they've gone back, so it's basically for the industry, you can see basically everything's, by from Thursday to Tuesday. So And I understand that because effectively however they kind of rearrange things, the industry was basically treating it. People live, you know, it's a really easy flight. It's an hour and a half from Los Angeles. It's a super easy flight for people who are, you know, in Los Angeles, based there in the industry. They just come in. It's a long weekend. Then they leave. Mm-hmm. If they even come in at all anymore, which is, of course, a whole nother issue because people are watching Lynx, you know?
Yeah. But I mean, I'm curious with this year, you know, I think in Manolan, in the piece that you report on for the Times, I liked you had this kind of three categories that the festival is sort of identified with, like it's, I don't know, I guess the art of the films, the brand of it, and then whether it's a player, I might have gotten that list wrong.
I have no idea what I wrote. I was in such a complete daze. And then we had to cut out 300 words at literally the last minute. So I was just like, chopping it up. It was so horrible. Anyway, I know it was it's a very unpleasant moment. I mean, Amy has been going longer. My first year was 1992, and then I skipped a year. And then I basically, except for one year, have been going pretty steadily from the mid-90s on. Mm-hmm. And I do not like going to Park City. It's really unpleasant. And at night, it's dangerous. I fall every single year. I have nice boots, but it's just so icy. And it's not accommodating for people who walk. You know, it's just not... And as somebody, it was actually John Powers once said to me, if only Robert Redford had liked to surf, we'd all be in Hawaii right now. But the dude liked to ski. Unfortunately. So, and it's just logistically really, it's not great, you know, and there's been a lot of talk about it maybe moving to Salt Lake. But Amy, that gossip has been going on for decades, right?
I mean, not with the heightened effect that it's having now. I mean, now it's on everyone's lips.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, when is the contract up? And does Park City really want Sundance there? Yeah. Or would they rather just have skiers and all of that?
Yeah, but it's so much money. It's $100 million that Utah basically gets from the festival every year. It's like $97 million. And I'm sure Utah does not want to give up that money. And I'm sure that as annoyed as townspeople are with having tens of thousands of people descend, that's also, there's a lot of money there, you know, whether you have an Airbnb or you're driving or you have a restaurant or whatever, it's a huge amount of revenue.
Look, my friends and I, for years, they're still there in a house where the owner gets their taxes paid with the rent they get in Sundance. They only rent during Sundance, and that takes care of paying their taxes for the entire year.
That's really amazing. So you can see, I think, probably.
And it's not that expensive. So taxes must be really low. But I mean, it's up there, like maybe they get.
Clearly, I haven't never figured it out in the system. My perspective is much, much more recent. So I've been free to like gripe without anything to back it up with. For me, every year, it's kind of maybe simplistic, just how much does it diverge from like reputation versus what I'm actually feeling about the artistic, you know, innovation or independence of the films, which is probably like unfair criteria. But on the other hand, when they're constantly blaring at you about like, whatever, you know, evolving change through story. I mean, this trailer this year was...
The trailer, oh my God. There's
word
a trailer.
Salad of buzzwords.
It's funny. I was talking to someone else who said, I counted how many times they used story. And I said, so did I. There is. So what happens at the festival, and I have to say, the trailers are annoying at Sundance. They're much, much worse at Toronto, which shows ads, which is really like, really makes you want to throw your popcorn at the screen. But it was interesting. It was a very kind of elegiac quality to a lot of the trailers. It started to feel like almost greatest hits, because what they were doing is that they were showing, there was like this one trailer that was a slideshow that started in the 80s. So I would like see people like, you know, my friend Tony Safford, who was there at the very beginning. So like it was like 85, which was when the festival was formed, US Festival. I don't believe that was his name. And then you would see like through the years. And it was actually very melancholic, because there were a number of people who are no longer with us, you know. It was like Harry Belafonte, Robert Altman. There was a couple of Roger Ebert, you know, and you would just see. And then there were a couple that really featured. There was two at least where Redford was featured rather prominently. One trailer in which he narrated the entire thing about like, when I started this, you know, I thought it was a place we could be independent. And then another one where it had story and they six different iterations of the word story, 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 storytelling, stories. I just wanted to scream. And I've always thought one of the problems with Sundance is they don't actually emphasize art enough. I'd like to hear the word art used more than story, frankly.
Okay. I'm glad they don't use the word art because they wouldn't know how to use it. But, I mean, and this is no slight on them. They have been using story that much from the beginning. That's all they ever talk about is story, and that's all they ever talk about in the labs.
Yep.
And it's a weird thing. In my old age, I've come around to believing in that more. I read somewhere, I was reading something, some quote by David Cronenberg, who said, the reason that we read novels and we go to films is that we can have a second identity with the characters in the story. And I thought that was kind of amazing.
Sure.
I mean, there is a filmmaker who is really out there on the edge, and there is identify with the characters in the story.
I am not against story, believe me, as you know. I just think that I would like a little bit more art in the conversation, even, yes, if they don't know how to use it. Because I think one of the problems is the way that story is used by the industry. And I'm afraid to say by too many people writing about movies where it's like, what's the story? There's no third act. The way this kind of very, very packaged way of like what constitutes even a story, you know, and it's very boring. And it's just people expect stories to work a certain way. And I think that Sundance doesn't help in that way. And the Sundance effect of using story a lot, you can really see in other parts of the industry, including at the Academy Museum, which is all about the story, the story, the story. Well, you know what? There are filmmakers who really, that's the least interesting thing about their work is story, you know? And I find it really aggravating, but we don't have to belabor it. It's just, you feel bludgeoned by it after a while, especially if you're seeing, as I did, like sometimes five movies a day, and you're just listening to these freaking trailers again and again and again. It's like, oh my God.
You've just picked up on it this year because it's always been there and it's always been as budgeting as this year. It's never been any different.
I would disagree, Amy, because I would disagree. I think it is actually worse than it has been in the past.
Well, it has a different meaning now because story is not just about three acts. Story is about finding people. They're not even yet filmmakers. Whose stories are different because the stories are diverse. They are not stories from white guys now. And the idea of diverse stories is really what has inspired the Sundance Labs and the
Absolutely.
Films of Sundance for increasing
Totally agree.
Amounts of time.
I agree with that. I would say the one thing that has changed over the 20 years, let's say, if not 30 years, is the way story has been adapted into larger cultural usage so that it, you know, the bank will say, well, what's your story? Like, it's the way that story has become. Everyone has a story. As far as I can tell, Jergens lotion has a story. The story of your dry hands, you know? I mean, it's just the way that story is ever present. There was a great essay in the New Yorker about the problem of the word story, which I would encourage everyone to read. It's really, really great, great, great piece of criticism.
Yeah.
But anyway, I think it's more so, and also I would just say the elegiac quality was interesting to me. And I do think that there's some kind of change happening. I don't think that anybody really knows what it is right now with Sundance, you know, and there's just a lot of different little kind of, there's a lot of gossip. First day, people kept talking about how it was in financial trouble. You know, well, the Institute is not in financial trouble. The Institute's money is fine. It makes total sense that the festival would have had a rough time because it didn't have full in-person festival for a couple of years because of the pandemic. I mean, there's a lot. We're still recovering from that. That's just going to take a long time.
Yeah, that's huge.
I mean, there was a very interesting, I don't know, I have the transcript because somehow I found it online. NPR did one of their collage reportage on the festival.
Mm-hmm.
And so the editor, who is someone who I don't know, Mandalit Del Barco.
Barco. Oh, yeah.
Did a very good thing and collected all these remarks from people, famous people like Steven Soderbergh and John Sloss and people I had no idea who.
And
they
then
are.
A couple of new, I heard that too, of a couple of new filmmakers. I had a problem with that report, but go ahead, Amy.
Well, the interesting thing on that report was that, I mean, just in terms of getting down to the nitty gritty of why people go to Sundance, they go to buy things. And for a long time, they went to buy dramatic features, that category. And documentaries were getting short shrift. Sloss, for some reason this year, says the streamers are only interested in buying documentaries. I don't know where he got that from, and I don't know what his definition of a documentary is. Is it only a music documentary about incredibly famous music people, or is it all documentaries? But it is true that features that did not have stars, it wasn't only they didn't get bought. I mean, no one even mentioned them or went to them or anything. I mean, there was no sense in anything that I've read about this Sundance that people were there actually looking for what the other word of Sundance is, new voices.
Yeah.
The new voices had no interest whatsoever in them. So that was odd.
Right. The one thing, though, and it's interesting, is that I think that what we have seen, and this is pre-pandemic even, and I think, you know, the one face that was missing from this whole, all these trailers that we saw at Sundance was Harvey Weinstein, you know, and I think with Harvey Weinstein gone and Miramax gone, you know, the post-2008 things started to change because you started to have like, yes, there were people having big buys like Coda out of Apple, but Apple's just insane and nobody knows what Apple is doing. Apple is just Apple. It's like, I don't even want to include it in the ecosystem because it's just so strange. But that I think what's happening right now because of what's happening in terms of all the streamers, right? There's so much like confusion right now with what's happening in streaming that people are putting a pause on things. And what we keep hearing is that there's going to be less original programming that is going to be produced, but you're still going to need to fill the hours. So I think what I've also heard are that people are not buying right out of Sundance with these big splashy deals. That was part of like what Harvey used to always do, you know, right? Like, you know, they have the bidding wars and people would be hunkered down. You know, there's not been that kind of thing for a while. There were still big deals. Netflix bought a terrible movie for $17 million. I laughed my ass off, man. I just
name it.
It's What's Inside.
It's What's Inside. Terrible title, first of all. It's so bad. Did you see it?
No, I didn't.
I thought it was like a mess, but in like a fun way.
Oh, my God. But it's so
ugly. I couldn't
believe
paying that amount for it.
It's so ugly. It would be perfect on Netflix. It's ugly. It's a bunch of people who are completely uninteresting to watch. And it's an elimination game again. Like Squid Game or the Rian Johnson movies, right? The Knives Out movies. It's another elimination where like it's the Agatha Christie, you know, like, now there are 9. Oops, now there are 8. Now that, you know.
It's Squid Game meets Euphoria kind of.
Yeah, like. No, exactly.
So, yeah, but the buys aren't really happening in the same way.
I think they will happen. I mean, they're one of the people who was interviewed was a filmmaker of Didi, a movie that people liked. You know, if I were a buyer, I wouldn't buy it either. It's a little inconsistent. I don't know. It's a nice movie, but it's like I've seen that movie 5 billion times, you know, except the difference is it's about an Asian American kid. And that's very nice, but it's a very banal movie otherwise. There's just nothing. And if, you know, if Amy's right, you know, and I agree with her about like finding new voices, it's like, you know, but I don't see you making any money off of that movie, you know, and certainly not in theaters. That's to me, you know, there's a kind of expectation that comes, but you know, this is a movie that will end up on a streamer at some point, but it didn't set the world on fire. People really liked it. It's charming, but I mean, you saw it too, right, Nick?
I started it, but couldn't really stick with it. I mean,
I've seen iterations of it, you know, many, many times. And so I just think in a way it's new because he's Asian American and the performances are nice. It was nice to see Joan Chen. She plays the mom. I really like her a lot. But other than that, every beat was completely familiar. There was nothing, you know, in terms of filmmaking that was interesting to me. So
I didn't finish Didi. I can't say the same thing, but hitting certain beats. Sometimes I see movies at Sundance where it feels like it's successful because it's demonstrating the filmmaker is demonstrating their like proficiency at hitting the beats and at doing a certain template. And that kind of, that's what story sometimes means to me. It's like making an effective narrative, whether or not it's like a particularly like original or whatever you want to say, it's that.
You know, I mean, there's a way that there's certain independent movies that they are, you start to feel like there's the, it's a genre, you know, it's like, and oftentimes with these younger, like coming of age stories, very frequently, you know, they're not all boyhood, you know, they follow a certain kind of like, they're confused, they're sad, there's something not wonderful about their lives. And then they go through some, maybe a little bit of growth, and then there's a crisis, and then there's a little bit, and then everything gets better and everyone smiles, the end. And everyone feels really good about it in the movie theater, except for me, Amy, and you.
So in the end, it becomes like a version of the Hollywood ending, basically learning how to do the Hollywood ending.
Self-actualization is just like the ending, is the generic ending of a lot of independent movies that we see at Sundance, you know, and I'm still waiting to be self-actualized. So I always find this very strange.
Well, I mean, but you could say something like that about a very simple narrative, like Showing Up. That is absolutely a classic three-act narrative with the kind of ending you're talking about. And yet it's an amazing movie, like pretty much like nothing you've seen before.
I don't see that as self-actualization, but whatever. I mean, you know, she's cranky and doing her artwork, you know, and she's going through this process, but I didn't. Anyway, we can.
Well, maybe we can dive in with some examples, and maybe we can start with, since we've been kind of griping about what's missing or what we'd like to see better, let's just start with the absolute best. We'll go right to cut to the chase of, yeah, what were like absolute highlights for each of you.
Steven Soderbergh's presence was definitely the highlight for me, I would say. Amy?
Presence was the highlight for me, but a close second was Jesse Eisenberg's A Real Pain.
Yeah,
that
me
was
too.
A close second.
That is a lovely movie. I really love that movie.
So let's start with that one, A Real Pain. I can sketch out the plot a little. So basically, yeah, Jesse Eisenberg directs. He also stars.
And wrote.
And wrote. Yeah, which is no small thing. Yeah. So, and he's with Kieran Culkin. They play cousins and they're going on, I guess the term is really a Holocaust tour, where you go in Poland and you visit sites, and it's an arranged tour. They have a tour guide and they are kind of an odd couple dynamic to a certain extent. Eisenberg's character is kind of a professional. I guess he's sort of a marketing, email marketing professional almost, or website marketing professional. He has a family. Whereas Culkin, you know, seems to be more drifting in life and is not doing so well. And yeah, they go on the tour and I don't know, they don't quite self-actualize, I don't think. Or...
No, they do not.
Yes, exactly.
They are pretty much the same. They have the same problems when they come out of it as when they go into it. And they have just a kind of moment where they can acknowledge that underneath they really care about each other. But in every moment of their encounter, the Kieran Culkin character is just driving Jesse Eisenberg nuts and to terrible, terrible, terrible embarrassment. I mean, this is, for me, probably the most interesting film about how do you deal with the Holocaust today? And it kind of wiped out the very, very bad taste that movie that everyone except me and maybe Manolo like.
Wait, are you talking about Zone of Interest?
I am.
We hate it. Everyone else seems to like it or love it, but we hate it.
Next to this film, that seems like such an easy, shallow choice. This film, these two guys, they know this thing existed. And they know that their grandmother was a survivor. And she's just died. And so they want to, or at least Jesse Eisenberg wants to pay some kind of respect to her by going on this Holocaust tour. And you don't really know why Kieran Culkin goes, because he is so kind of against this and so confused about his relationship to any of this. But he goes because he thinks he should. And then for him, it's just pure torture. I mean, this guy who's leading the tour and telling them what to do and what they should think about and all of that. And he's just totally acting out and embarrassing Jesse Eisenberg, who's just so constricted and such a mess of anxiety. And, you know, I think that Jesse Eisenberg is one of the great American actors. And I didn't like his earlier movie. I mean, I had a lot of problems with his first movie. But this movie is just so precise. And the great thing about it is blanketed with Chopin piano music. And I don't mean that it's wall to wall, but it comes up, you know, every time they're traveling or there's no dialogue and then there's a lot of space without any music. And it's one of those movies that you can't say is, just like you should never say Chopin when it's played well, is just melancholy. It isn't. I mean, it has this exuberance because they are alive and they can do this. The tonality of this movie is just so extraordinary to me.
Yeah, I think the tone is amazing. I think that the Culkin character, at one point, he does, I believe, say that he was very close to his grandmother. And he also, I think, at one point says that he wants to be on the trip to hang out. But it also, as time goes on, you also get, I mean, they're nicely sketched, the two cousins. You know, one is very straight in all senses of the word, you know, kind of, but is very, still has this great unease, right? For someone who's like doing all the things you're supposed to do, marriage, career, child, whereas the other one is very rootless. And that's really interesting. You know, I saw it as really about, you know, I think we all, or I don't know if everyone, but certainly Amy and I know the children of survivors of the Holocaust, you know, and there's a lot of, I mean, this is part of what Art Spiegelman does in Maus, is talk about what it is. But I think part of what this movie is that it's the generational trauma. And, you know, I'm very aware of the word trauma being used for every single thing. But I think in this case, it's very apt that this is that, you know, it doesn't just end with the children of survivors. It continues generationally. And there's this amazing shot in the movie. Culkin's character is sitting at an airport where he likes hanging out at airports. And it's, you see two Hasidic Jews behind him sitting there. And it's very much for me about this kind of identity in the very long shadow of the Holocaust. It's this generational thing. And they're both, you know, the reverberations of it are affecting them very profoundly. I want to just put in a brief note that the tour guide, it's such a nice bit of comedy, you know, with the tour guide who is played by Will Sharp, who is an actor that was in The Last White Lotus. He played the husband of the Aubrey Plaza character, but he also directed The Electric Life of Louis Wayne, which is just so trippy, which I just love. And one of the things that I think the Culkin character is completely right about is, you know, the tour guide never shuts up and he's packaging everything. And Culkin's character is annoying and he does embarrass everyone, but he's also right sometimes, very right. You know, it's just like, let us just live in, like, you don't have to fill everything up with talk, which is funny because both of the cousins talk a lot. I mean, it's really wonderfully scripted. You know, it's very funny moments of sadness and everything else. And I thought one of the things was very striking about the direction was that watching the movie, you could see how much room Eisenberg was giving Culkin to do what he was doing, because that is an astonishing performance. It is an astonishing performance. But you could see it as, you know, the director, you can just see that he is allowing this. And there was, I saw, it was not the premiere, but I saw that one of the screenings and Eisenberg came out afterwards and he talked about how it was really frustrating working with Culkin, who would not like prepare, you know, would not do anything. And then he'd be like, are you ready? You have 5 pages of dialogue. He's like, oh yeah, I'll take a look. And then Eisenberg said, and then he would just do this astonishing thing. He said, he called him a genius. He said, and it was so beautiful, actually, you know, to like listen to an actor director who is starring in the movie himself be so blown away by his co-star. It was such a generous, beautiful thing to see. I just had to add that.
We love this movie.
Yeah.
I'm just here to concur. Yeah, and that was wonderful hearing him talk about it that way. I don't have much more to add to that. I mean, and I guess it's a personal story too. I guess that kind of is pretty amazing too. And apparently they visit the house where I think Eisenberg's own grandmother, I want to say.
I believe so, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Where they were, he makes a distinction. At first he said where they left, they fled. And then he said forced to flee.
Yes. Yes. It's like, exactly. So when you're hauled off to a concentration camp, it's not like you're fleeing. You're being.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Basically kidnapped and tortured. And,
yeah.
But she survived. And through her, we get Jesse Eisenberg. And I am grateful. Yeah. It's kind of a perfect movie, Alma. I mean, it's really, really good. I don't want it to be quoted on that, but I just think it's really, really, it just hits Amy's right. The tonality is so.
Yeah. I mean, not to compare other movies against it, but it feels like it does what so many other movies are trying to do, you know, in a way with hitting this exact sort of mix. But it's something people can see. I guess that it was acquired. So,
It was acquired for a lot of money by Searchlight. I think they probably overpaid because while we love it, I don't think that it's going to be a massive hit. You know, it's a very delicate movie that is not the kind of movie that people go to anymore. I would love to think that people would.
Yeah. No, it's let's hope for the best.
Yeah, I certainly hope people come out and see it. I mean, because I also do think it is sort of directed in a way that is making it open to more people than another version of this movie might have been.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's a real pain. I thought maybe we can pick up on a comment Amy made earlier, just that this festival, this edition, had films from both Steven Soderbergh and Richard Linklater.
Yeah. Well, the first year I was at Sundance, that was the year of Sex, Lies, and Videotape. And as everyone says, that's when the story changed, the story of Sundance, because that's when it got put on the map for the Hollywood people. The curious thing about that was it didn't win the grand prize because the jury in those days, like the jury, I think this year, didn't give the prize to Jesse Eisenberg. They gave the prize to a film that they think needs a prize. It's kind of like charity prize giving. And so in those days, it gave the grand prize to a wonderful film. It was Nancy Savoca's first film that won the grand prize in 89, not Sex, Lies, and Videotape.
True Love?
Yeah, that's what it won.
That's a lovely movie. That's a lovely movie.
Yeah. True Love, yeah. And then 2 years later, everyone has the dates wrong on this. 2 years later, Richard Linklater's Slacker was at Sundance. And so it's amazing to see that at least two people who started with these very good early films have had really big, consistent careers, you know, and now are coming back. And in the case of Soderbergh, he has the feeling that he can do anything. I mean, who in his position would make a movie like Presence? I mean, it's extraordinary that he would do that. And inevitable, and it was really the only narrative about which I can say, oh, this is really radical what it does formally.
Absolutely.
To have that first-person camera, which is the presence of the ghost, but the presence of the auteur, the presence in, you know, that we refuse to actually say is there. It was so interesting to see that.
Just to kind of go into a little bit of formally, I mean, it's really interesting. So it's divided into scenes that are themselves divided by kind of longer, a few seconds of black. So the scene happens, then there's some black leader, which is not leader because it's digital, but whatever, you understand, black. And they're all amazing single takes.
No.
They're not single takes. They look like it.
They're not. If you saw it again, you would see
that. Oh, they cheat a little bit. Ah, okay. But there are a lot of very long takes, and that he was working as his own camera operator. And one of the funny details after the premiere was that he was apparently, so it's set in this two-story, very lovely house, older house with a very big staircase. And so a lot of action and this camera, which seems like it's a ghostly presence, right? And it's kind of darting around. I kept thinking of hummingbirds, you know, darting around, but floating, has very floaty. He was wearing apparently martial arts slippers while he was doing this. Yeah. So that he, you know, you wouldn't hear his footfalls as he was running around the house. So it was very quiet. But I just was like, he must have been working out because...
Well, that's what I said to him in this. I said, how many hours did you work out? And he said, no. I mean, he tested dozens of cameras and he found this new Sony, one of those Sony cameras that shoots still photographs primarily, but shoots very good video. And it was light enough on the stabilizer that he could hand hold it. Mm. Although in those very long takes.
Yeah, no, I was just like, the dude has some biceps is all.
But it was going up and down the stairs. That was the hard part.
Yeah.
Because he said, there is no version of me that could have gone up and down those stairs without looking at my feet. So what he had to do was figure out the moves of the camera without looking through the viewfinder while he was shooting those series.
Amazing.
I mean, it's amazing.
And it's so fluid, you know, I mean, it's really, really, what's so interesting is that it becomes this disembodied presence becomes very embodied, you know, simply because through the movement, it feels like, it feels embodied, even if it's this ghostly presence that, you know, some of the characters can kind of intuit or feel the presence, which is super interesting. The one thing I will say that I don't love about the movie is the way the actual, the quality of the image, you know, it's not attractive digital. It just isn't. It's just not. And he's such a wonderful shooter. And I just like, I wish that the actual visual quality was better, you know, I mean, it's fine, but I wish it was prettier or something. It just looks like digital from almost like 10 years ago or something.
Interesting. I did not have that problem with it. And I usually do. I did see it in a theater in New York before the festival. So no, I mean, I just completely gave up to this ghost, you know, like that's the way the ghost sees. It's kind of like the only film I've ever seen that has that kind of relationship to ghosts is the Kiyoshi Kurosawa movie that has a one-word title about the kids who start committing suicide they see this one kid who committed suicide coming at them from their video screens. They're working in a computer lab. And that has made on terrible video. And it just didn't bother me. But no, I just think that the really scene that will allow this to be classified as a horror film is so terrifying because you realize that there is a person holding that camera that is that close to something really horrible happening.
Yes.
And you just have this totally terrible feeling about the camera being there and letting this thing happen.
Right.
You know, for the seconds that it does let it happen. I mean, it's like a moral choice. How much are you simply an observer, even if you're a ghost, and how much you go and do something about this? Yeah,
exactly. It's going to be tough to write about, you know, because without giving away the thing, this other thing that is happening in the house that we cannot talk about because that would ruin it, you know, and you want people to have the same pleasure of discovery, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I was really just struck by how Soderbergh basically gives a great performance too. Like he is the ghost, so it's a performance.
Yeah.
And it's such an interesting, it's so subtle because it's not the sort of thing where he's like looming and you're aware of it's like this menacing ghost. A lot of times the ghost seems really frantic.
Yes.
And is just like trying to keep up with the reality that's in front of them and acutely aware of how, you know, he or she, I'm not sure we really get to know what the ghost's background
is. No, we don't know. We don't know.
What their background is or anything. You know? I mean, for all we know, this could be like ghosts from the 15th century or something. They're like totally.
Well, that's exactly. Right, exactly. It's just that, and you, because the movie actually opens with the house and inside the house. So, and everything. Also happens inside the house. We never leave the house. And it's like the ghost is kind of looking out And it's almost like the ghost is waiting for the house to be moved into, you know, like kind of hanging out, just waiting, what's going on? And it's like, oh, here's his family. And like, oh, wow, things are bad in this family. And so, and that's weird too, because the family is haunted already. By the time the family comes in, the family has been through a very bad thing. And the family is haunted. And it's almost like the ghost is like the, seems like it's just hanging out, waiting for someone to show up. And like, oh no.
Yeah.
It's so fun. It's really, and also just, we have to say, it was written by David Keep, who also wrote a movie that I think all of us like very much, Kimmy, mm-hmm. another movie that takes place in a constricted space, you know, and it's just so much fun to see how much fun they're having, Keep and Soderbergh, within this very constricted space. Like, what can you do? I love constricted space movies. Not all of them, obviously, but, you know, it's like, it's cool.
Yeah.
It's cool.
Yeah. And just one last thing. I mean, on that, that's what I attributed the kind of quality of the camera, or the look of the camera a little bit, was just to kind of somehow echo or enhance that feeling that you're kind of closed in. Also, he seems to have a little thing just generally, like between like High Flying Bird or Bubble, or I mean, sometimes he just seems to like to lean into a certain look. So that's presence. And I just want to make time for Richard Linklater also had a movie. So, and I didn't hear a lot of people talking about it, which is too bad. Cause I really liked it. And I guess maybe it's cause it was part of a series technically.
Oh, you mean the two movies? The one was the Texas one. And yeah. Yeah. There's two.
Yeah. Because Hitman was there, but we had already seen Hitman in New York Film Festival, but it's already sold. And that's a huge Netflix deal.
Right. Yeah.
And Hitman is wonderful, but he had this series that he directed the first episode only of this series, which is based on a book. And the showrunner for the series, God Save Texas, is the guy who wrote the book. He's a very famous political journalist, actually. And this, I mean, Richard Linklater, anyone else doing this, I would have killed them. Just like I would say, God is never going to save Texas, and why do you continue to live there? And Richard Linklater is one of the only person who I don't feel like killing them when they give me this answer, which is that they were brought up there, and it's their home, and everything they remember about it from then and from different periods. This town where Richard Linklater spent 10 years of his life, Huntsville, where he went to high school, has the largest penitentiary. I don't know if it's in the U.S. prison system or in the Texas prison system. And they regularly now, the year after Linklater moved out, which was 81, after he finished high school and moved to somewhere else in Texas, they began again to do executions. And they do more executions than any other prison or all the other prisons in the United States.
Yeah, exactly. Texas does. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's even so when you're in this town, like the Greasy Spoon has fry 'em up burgers listed. I mean, it's so horrendous. And he interviews all these people and the degree to which they compartmentalize. Well, yeah, we hear the siren going off and we know what that means, but then it goes off and we just don't think about it anymore. And it's mostly people who are very young, who just refuse to think about the fact that this is happening. And
there's a college, right? There's a school.
And it's a criminal justice. It's a big college of criminal justice.
Yeah.
That's what it is. And it's really kind of amazing movie.
Well, it's an interesting movie.
And it is an hour and a half long. It could be a feature, but it's the first episode.
It's 87 minutes. I just looked it up. Yeah. So it's based on the Lawrence Wright nonfiction, the great Lawrence Wright. And they turns out that he and Linklater have been friends for a really long time, like very, very long time. And it's the way that it's the casualness. It's a kind of seeming casualness, the way that Linklater kind of like starts talking in his lovely voice. And it seems like he's just, well, I just kind of woke up and I'm going to start talking to you. But it's very nicely shaped, you know, the way he does it. But his manner is very, he's not hectoring. He's not yelling at anybody. He's really trying to understand this place in a very open-minded, very calm way that I'd be like, what? You know, it's none of that. He's got this very laid back affect, you know, and he brings that to an end. It's really powerful. in a way, mm-hmm. because he exudes decency.
Yeah.
The man mm-hmm. just seems so principled and so ethically minded and so like honestly trying to understand this place. And he, toward the beginning, he talks about how everyone has a relationship to where they grew up, you know, and he's talking about this place and, you know, he brings his mother into it. You know, you learn about his mom and you start to understand more about Linkletter and you think, ah, I see this. He is definitely the son of this woman, you know, and it's just a very, the way he almost seems to be backing into it, but it's not. It's just not a didactic. So many documentaries, you know, you feel lectured at, you feel like, you know, yelled at in some way, guilted. And he is just, it's kind of almost philosophical. He has this problem and he's just going to try to understand it. I found it very moving. And, you know, it's coming to HBO and it will be airing, I believe, at the end of February. But I was super disappointed because I went to the first press screening and there were about a dozen people in the press screening, you know, and it was just kind of like, I wondered, is it just that people like the people in the movie who don't really have any answers or don't know what to say, that people are just confused. I don't know. It was kind of, and no one was talking about it. I mean, it's really good. It's Avi's right.
Yeah.
And I just, so people have the title, I don't know if we said it yet, the series that it's part of is God Save Texas. And this one is called Hometown Prison. And I think that might be the cause of it, because the way it's listed, you'd kind of have to look for it because it's in the episodic.
Yeah.
And then it was weirdly presented. It's, they try to make clear that it is three, they use some weird language. You see like three non-sequential, like individual episodes or something. So it was, yeah, it was very weird. I don't
very
know.
Very awkward.
Yeah.
I saw the whole series.
Oh, wow.
And then they called me and said, well, you have to make clear that the only one that was shown was Richard Linklater's, but now you've seen the whole series. So do you think you could not write about the others until, you know, it drops? So they were worried about the timing of when it would get reviewed. And the two other episodes, they're by young women directors, and they're pretty weak. They try to do the same kind of thing that Linklater does, but they just end up pulling their punches. Mm. I mean, it's so evident that what they're doing is pulling their punches and saying, but in the end, we really love Texas, you know?
Yeah, because he doesn't really need to do that. I just want to talk briefly about Rob Peace. Did anyone else see that?
No.
And part of what's interesting about it, it's also based on a nonfiction book, and it's directed by Chiwetel Ejiofor, the British actor, and he actually also plays the father. And I guess it popped into my mind because prison is also part of it. So it's a young man's name, Rob Peace. He's actually got another name, but he goes by Rob Peace. And it's based on a nonfiction book by someone who knew him. And he's growing up in New Jersey, and he's brilliant. He's a brilliant kid. He's just, you know, he is just a brilliant kid. And he ends up, goes to prep school, and he ends up getting into Yale. I mean, he's this kind of brilliant kid who just gets, you know, effortlessly does, he aces the SATs, and he's very, very decent kid. Meanwhile, when he's younger, his father has been wrongfully, maybe, though you don't really know, imprisoned. And it's a story of a young Black man, I guess I didn't say that yet, and his connection to his home, which is in, you know, terrible shape. I forget, I'm sorry, which city in New Jersey it is. And he's being increasingly in this very rarefied atmosphere of Yale, but he wants to always go back home, even if his mother is very like, you need to get out of here. You need to get out of here. And he's very pulled back to home. Meanwhile, his father, the only person who's interested in his father getting out of jail is him. And so he becomes very mired in these attempts to try to get his dad out of prison, while he's also this brilliant student doing really rarefied science, like so beyond my brain level, you know? So I'm like, what? And it's about these kind of different clashes, and it's very much about America. And it's a, you know, it's interesting because it's a very straight movie in a lot of ways. And I was very moved by it. It's very moving. The performances are lovely. And it's very upsetting. And, you know, it's a very, 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 very upsetting story. But it's a, in terms of, you know, back to Linkletter, most of the people who have been put to death are people of color. Overwhelmingly, you know, I think most of them are Black. I think, Amy, I believe that it says that, you know, so this is.
Oh, yeah, it says that.
Yeah. And so in this movie, we just actually see a story, recreating a story based on a real person's life of how this system just eats people up and what it does to people generationally. And it's very affecting. And, you know, I think we always are looking for interesting, fresh, formally inventive movies, but sometimes a really good old fashioned drama with some melodrama in it, you know, and buckets of tears, I'm just happy to be there for as well.
No, thanks. I'm really glad to hear about that. That's actually one I was hoping to see in whatever I have before we turn to a pumpkin.
But again, very straight, you know, just a very, yeah. But just a very nicely done, very, very affecting.
Well, could we just go through a list and mention a bunch of movies that I think everyone should see?
All right, speed round. Amy,
speed round. I really think everyone should see a documentary called Ebelin. Anyone see Ebelin?
Not yet.
It is really interesting, especially if, like me, you never play games with avatars. It is really wonderful, yeah. Doc. And for me, the great doc that I saw was the doc that won. It's Porcelain Wars. And it shot in Ukraine. And one of the directors is a guy who trains special forces and makes the point that most of the people fighting in Ukraine are civilians who now have to fight for their country. I mean, not that they're being drafted. They have to do it because they need to fight for their country. It has the most extraordinary, harrowing footage, sustained, long thing that this unit does that I've never seen anything before like it in a movie. And it isn't in any way a war-torn movie. Yeah. It has also tons of animals.
Oh,
And they don't die.
Okay, thank you for that.
And so there's that. And Black Box. No one is talking about Black Box.
I'm going to watch that tonight.
Because, you know, here we've been through Me Too and everything. But this is an extraordinary story. This is in Japan. And it's a Japanese very young journalist who is raped by the Japanese Washington bureau chief in Tokyo.
Wow.
She's raped by him. And the case goes on and they will not hear a criminal case. But eventually, 5 years after, she wins the civil case and he still brings it back. She kept a video diary all the way through.
Wow.
She shot everything, including stuff that she was just wanting because she's a journalist. I mean, she's 20 years old. She's a journalist and she decides, this is what journalists do. I'm going to tell the story of my own rape and the trials and all these things that happened along these 5-7 years because it starts in 2015 and it ends in 2022 and hasn't ended because he's bringing now a counter civil suit after she won. And so she had all this material, a lot of which she had forgotten that she shot. And so it's like evidence, but it's her talking, keeping a diary. And she gave it all to an editor. And the editors put it all together. And she said that she didn't even remember that at one point she really has a nervous breakdown. And she delivers a suicide note to the camera and ends up in the ER. And she didn't remember that she had shot any of that. And the editor said, this is part of the story and we have to keep this in. So she has shot this movie and brought her all this material and said, I guess, put it together. And then the editor did that and she worked with her. But
holy hell.
It's an amazing story. And she is just amazing. And that she falls apart not till 5 years after. But, I mean, she seems so composed and so with it. And then she begins to have serious flashbacks. It also has the best trigger warning thing at the beginning, which just says, some of the material here may trigger some people. I am triggered, too. And I find that the best thing to do is just put your head down for a minute and take really deep breaths and then come back.
Oh, what an amazing way to start a movie. Wow.
Yeah. So I just think it's extraordinary.
Yeah, I love that movie. Black Box Diaries. I guess the original book is called Black Box, and then they added Diaries for the title for the movie. And in terms of documentary, Manola, did you want to shout out
Oh, I liked quite a few. I like Gaucho Gaucho as the people who the guys who did Truffle Hunters. It doesn't have as much kind of sociopolitical context as the Truffle Hunters, but it's extremely beautiful, shot black and white, and it's about gauchos. And it's just, you know, kind of narrowing in on a disappearing way of life. So I like that a great deal. I liked a movie that's not documentary, but draws on history, trans film called
Desire Lines.
Desire Lines. Thank you very much. Very crude. It looks like it was shot for about $5 and change. I mean, really super, super crude, but ends up being very lovely movie about desire. And I can't be much more specific because I saw it at the very beginning of the festival and my brain is just completely lost. I really liked the Will Ferrell documentary that was directed by a guy who made an absolutely horrible movie called Strays. I can barely even like understand it's a movie that I just didn't think would work at all. Like I just couldn't believe, but it's a road trip movie and it's really interesting. He goes on a road trip with his friend Harper, who has transitioned to a woman, and they've known each other a long time. And it's kind of like what you would Will Ferrell just kind of is very asks questions and clearly loves his friend. The friend, they just love each other. And it unexpectedly, I walked in with such like, meow. Show me, you know, and it does. So I was very moved by it, particularly given how incredibly conservative Utah is. I mean, it's as deep red as you could imagine. It's been that way for a really long time. They just have passed trans, you know, laws, bathroom laws that, you know, during the festivals. So I felt like it was good that Will Ferrell put his name on this, you know, anything to counter the really, truly hateful things that are going on in this country is good.
That's one I really wanted to see, but I missed it. I missed that window.
It is what it is, but I really was moved by it, you know?
Yeah. Well, we can go from hopeful to the hopeless.
No,
I just mean in terms of, talk about War Game, if you're still game.
Oh my
God, what the?
It is a WTF movie that, cause I haven't had this. So I don't read about the movies before I see them. And I thought it was a documentary. I walk in, I'm like watching it. And then I'm like, well, this can't be a real, this is obviously it's a fiction film. Cause this can't be real. And then of course it is a documentary. And I haven't had that kind of experience. I had no way of writing about it, which I'm so looking forward to writing about it at length at some point. But oh my, it is a WTF documentary. Amy, do you want to talk about it?
I don't know exactly how to talk about it, except that I think that people should see it. But I also think it's really dangerous because it gives a lot of people a lot of scenarios that they could use in exactly the way they are used by the various side in this movie that they might not be imaginative enough to think about.
Yeah, but I mean, okay, we should back up.
I don't know
up.
How it, to talk about it.
We should back up and explain what it is. So what it is, when I finally figured out, is that it's there's a veterans organization that has coordinated this effort, is what happens if something like January 6th happens again? What do you do? How do you prevent? Let's say it happens, but it's actually worse, like because it could have been much worse. How do you respond? And there are different people in it who are, you know, you recognize the governor of Montana plays the president. So you have all these people who are drawn from different agencies and departments who are playing different roles, or playing the head of defense, the vice president, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they're basically confronted with another January 6th, but much worse, right? And then there are other people who are playing this so-called patriot group, a traitorous group. A traitorous, scary group that it's coordinating it. So it's really fascinating. And like Alexandra Vindman shows up, you know, so it's really, these are some people you will recognize and you will go WTF as this is happening. The one thing, my biggest takeaway from this is that they need to get AOC in there like right away, because they have no sense of how to use social media at all. The government is falling, like all the people in the room, in the situation room, nobody is on social media the way they need to be on. I'm like, get AOC in there. She'll know what to do. It was crazy to me that they were so terrible about social media. Just insane.
Yes, but the big tension in this is what does the president do? I mean, the good guys, not the bad guys, are saying, what does the president do? Does he federalize this immediately?
Right.
Does he call in the troops?
Right.
And he doesn't want to do this. And you sit there and say, you're being too conservative. You have to. And they're all talking about the aftermath. You know, if you call in the army and the army kills these people, you will have a civil war in your hands. But if you don't call in the army, then they're going to win. And they're actually storming Arizona and storming air bases. And I mean, the game goes that far so that the other side is really doing things that's much worse than January 6th.
Well, no, I'm saying it's exponentially worse than January 6th. So what if they had a coordinated effort where they were actually taking over state capitals at the same time, not just storming the Capitol, but actually had coordinated efforts across the country? And it's really interesting because it becomes very much a kind of discussion of the state's rights versus the federal government. And I think he makes the absolute right decision, which we will not say, but it absolutely makes sense. But as it's happening, you just keep going, I mean, I just talk about trigger warnings. I needed one for that movie, I have to tell you, because I was just so completely freaked out watching it.
Yeah, it was crazy. And I saw it in this weird context. They had like a New York screening of it with afterwards they had a panel of all the people who were in it.
Oh.
Or like a number of them.
Wow.
Wow.
You know, the governor of Montana, Heidi Heitkamp.
Who is amazing. Who's actually, what a firecracker that woman is.
I was hoping she would just run the room. You know, she was great. And also an executive from this veterans organization.
The woman who was the Marine. Yeah,
yes.
She's really amazing. I don't know. I'm sorry, I don't remember her name.
Yeah, she was incredible. Yeah, at this. And I also, you kind of wish that, because in the movie, she's kind of running this control room that they sometimes cut to where they let you know like, okay, now we're going to put in this like, you know, chaos agent going on here, which is because a lot of the problem, yeah, is social media misinformation and just at the right moment making people think that, oh, the US government is now dropping bombs on us or something, and
right
stuff like that, which yeah, they're completely unprepared for. And then it feels so glacial, they're deciding what to do about it. So yeah, but they had this panel talking about it afterwards, which was really interesting. And I mean, the movie is technically bipartisan. The people who showed up for the panel were pretty uniformly Democrats, so for the record. And that included Wesley Clark.
So Wesley Clark, right, is also in the movie, you know,
that's right.
So that's when I was like, oh, Vindman's in it. Clark. I'm like, you know, but I was having a very hard time like processing this, you know, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
So who is releasing this, or when is it happening, or what is happening with it?
That's a good question. Yeah, I don't know who the distributor is on that. I don't know. For some reason, I thought there was, but now I don't know.
I think it will. If it doesn't have distribution, it will get, because there was a lot of attention. People were, you know, people have written a lot about it.
Yeah.
And I think because a lot of people were completely freaked out about it.
I mean, there was a big panel at Sundance also.
Oh, okay.
Live there. But I have no idea what's happening.
And yeah, at Sundance, it was given this sort of unique status of like a special event screening. It wasn't even like in any of the categories.
We should mention the directors are Jesse Moss and Tony Gerber.
And Jesse Moss also co-directed Girl State, which was also in the festival this year. So yeah, War Game, in case you were, I don't know that people are feeling complacent, but just so you feel that much more panicked.
Yeah, this is, I mean, I spent all of January 6th, you know, on Twitter, just basically like, is anyone watching what's happening? You know, so I just am like, yeah. And it's scary given like what Twitter has become, like how you just think about, this is again why they need AOC and they're doing something. At least someone under the age of, you know, someone younger than me, like, you know, actually in the room doing something, because it just felt like, come the fuck on. They weren't responding.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it was just really, oh my gosh. Anyway, I thought it was fascinating. Fascinating movie.
I mean, on that Twitter, in this case, it's like instrumentalized into like a weapon of war, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a weapon of war. That's really well put. Really, 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 really. That's exactly right. And that's was part of why I was like, get AOC in there. I'm going to keep hammering that. I was like.
Yeah. All right. Well, we could end there, although I don't know. Is there Is there any lighter thing we can talk about? Or I was kind of curious about a couple of movies, just what each of you thought.
You want to keep just do a fire round? We'll just quickly.
Sure, yeah.
Amy and I will be like.
But for example, one good pretty high profile movie in terms of its placement as well, like in the weekend and evening screening, was Love Lies Bleeding, also because of the stars. You had Kristen Stewart in there. And Rose Glass, second feature after St. Maud's. So it was pretty anticipated, I guess. Thoughts on that one?
I didn't see it.
I enjoyed it. I mean, I'm not going to make any great claims for it. I really love watching Kristen Stewart. So that basically, even when she's in, because she was in a bad movie there, Love Me, whatever that was not good. That was rough. That was really hard. Though not as rough as the Ryan Fleck and Anna Bodine movie. What was that called?
You must be referring to Freaky Tales.
Oh my God. That was one of those movies where you're watching thinking, I can't believe I ever liked anything that these people directed, but I really did. You know, I mean, Amy and I were at Sundance together, you know, and we saw Half Nelson there. And I think that's a lovely movie. I really love Sugar, you know, and I just think, I don't know what happened, but.
And then they went and directed Marvel movies and never recovered.
Exactly. This is a disaster. It's terrible. I mean, I was so just sitting there thinking, what am I watching? Like, this is so, I mean, but Love Lies Bleeding, it's a genre piece. It's got moments of kind of light surrealism and it's pretty grubby. It's in like Nowheresville. I wrote this Nowheresville, USA, where two outsiders come together and, you know, blood and love. And but I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it. I will not make big claims for it, but I enjoyed it.
It's very like a lot of like smash cuts and sort of things.
Yeah,
and,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I had a friend who was telling me, because it felt really loud in my screening. I don't know if we were in the same screening, but it just felt like the volume was really up. And then he said that they had actually asked, you know how with the theaters, they're like, they want the levels, whatever, to 7 point or something, and that they wanted it, whatever the highest was. So,
to quote Spinal Tap, 211.
Yeah, exactly. So that's Love Lies Bleeding. And then another one, Exhibiting Forgiveness.
Oh, Amy has some thoughts.
Yeah.
Okay. We cackle.
You know, for me, Andre Holland can do no wrong. I mean, he's a great actor and he's the best. I mean, he gives the movie some credibility. It's by a really very good black painter making his first movie, and he doesn't know anything at all about how to make a movie or how to write a script for a movie, but it has an extraordinary thing in it. I mean, I'm very glad I saw it. Andre Holland is a painter, and he makes very nice paintings that sell, and he has a white, really ballsy kind of Mary Boone style in the old Mary Boone dealer, and she wants to sell all these paintings, and he's not sure. And he has an experience of going back and seeing his mother and unfortunately seeing his father, who was violent and abused him and his mother extremely violently, and cannot get through his head that this was wrong. And he's been in prison, he's a homeless person, and he comes back and Andre Holland encounters him, and he begins to paint differently. And he begins to paint these portraits of his mother and his father that are different from the portraits, from the paintings. They're all representational that have sold. And he's at a show toward the end of the movie of his work, and everything in the show is sold. And someone comes up to him and says, you know, I have a painting of yours hanging over my bed, and now I've bought this. And it's this anguished painting of his father that this guy has bought and wants to hang in his house. And I just had never thought before about painters when their work becomes really personal, what it must be like for them to know that it's hanging in these people's houses who they probably loathe. I mean, this buyer was a loathsome white guy with lots of money. And, you know, it just never entered my head that he was making better paintings. And what would happen to them?
I thought that was a really good scene. I agree. I think that the worst part of the movie, there's some really terrible dialogue. The screenplay is the weakest part of it. I think the performances, I think, you know, Andre Holland, what Amy said, I mean, he's such a beautiful screen actor. He's just wonderful. And it's quite moving. But that's actually a really, really good scene, because it's this gallery show. And this man who's bought his work has this feeling of kind of proprietariness, like he touches him, he puts his hand, and doesn't he say, like, he bought a painting for his daughter who's at like some like Dartmouth or something, you know, and it's this, you know, it's like, I own you now, because I, you know, it's this kind of creepy patron, you know, the client and the artist and the relationship. And it's very fraught, and it's really well done, I think, you know. So there's really good moments and some really not, and he's haunted by his past. And I thought the stuff with the dad was really good. This is another father son kind of coming into, because the father had been an addict and alcoholic, and the father is in AA and now believes that because he's cleaned up, that everyone should kind of forgive him, like, because he's done his amends, right? And it's like, no, you don't get, just because you're innate, like, good for you, you've cleaned up your act. But I actually really like that. Like, that was the toughness of the movie, not in some very banal stuff, but about, like, because what kind of forgiveness are we talking about? You know, it's like, you were horrible. And there's this flashback to some really terrible abuse this child endured, you know, from his father, who was a complete addict at the time. And about forgiveness and generation, again, this generational pain and how it shapes people. You know, I just wish that it had a better script. I thought it was pretty lamentable.
And I wish he knew where to put the camera, because he doesn't.
Yeah. But there's some really good scenes in it, you know, and I think that, you know, pointing out the gallery scene was like, that is very fraught. There's a lot going on there, you know, and it's bristling with a lot of stuff, you know, so it's a mixed bag.
Yeah, no, that scene, it's just very electric too, because I kind of had no idea where this was going to go. It didn't feel like this, like, kind of stagey kind of confrontation or rebellious gesture or something. Did either of you see Sugar Cane? Just talking about forgiveness.
No.
Like, I mean, forgiveness in a totally different way comes up there, and also what that would even mean or how that's even possible. The movie about quote-unquote residential schools in Canada
where
indigenous
children were basically taken away from their parents and their homes and their families and their cultures, and kind of like forced to like leave all that behind by the Canadian government. Just like,
yeah, and serially assaulted by the priests. So that movie, is also, I think, a hard watch, but also worth watching.
But you recommend it. Okay. I've not a lot of time to finish watching all these Sundance movies. There's so many movies.
I know. And with that, I mean, I guess we can kind of bring it to an end. I'm curious about Kneecap.
I like Kneecap, you know. Okay. It's Irish rappers, you know, rapping in Yeah. And it's really interesting. And Gaelic is such an interesting language anyway. And it's fun. I enjoyed it. So.
Oh, cool. Okay. Yeah. So should we bring it to a landing there and just mention that the special recommendation for cat owners?
Oh, that's right. for people who have animals, this will be a perfect movie to watch, who have cats, really. Movie to watch at home is Every Little Thing, which is about a woman who rescues hummingbirds in Los Angeles. You don't really learn a lot about her, but they use amazing macro cameras to capture the birds that are looming very large on your television screen, because I watched it at home. And like Nick and like Amy, I have cats, and we had this one cat who was there, who I realized was watching this movie very, very intently. I'd never seen Pierre, my cat, watch a movie, and he was completely transfixed. And I was transfixed by those birds, because they're huge, because they're using this they're so beautiful. I love hummingbirds. So there's not a lot to the movie. I enjoyed it, but I think it's a special movie for cat people. So.
Absolutely. Play it big. play it close.
And loud, so you hear the
of
their amazing wings. Yes.
The thrumming of the wings. All right. We'll end there. Manola and Amy, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you so much, Nick. Thank you, Manola. Nice to see both of you.
So nice to see you guys.
Long live Sundance, I guess.
I guess. I just have to get used to slipping and falling, at least. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with host Nicholas Rapold. You can support the podcast by signing up at rapold.substack.com. Thank you for listening.